fine.
Hi, Rabina.
Good.
Thanks for everything.
Good.
But as for just what happened now, can you just see if this is somewhere on the right track in regards to the emptiness in the label I? Because I've never heard that. I've heard many, many explanations of emptiness, but I've never heard the three parts.
And that, the what?
I've never heard the three parts explained before like you did, and that blew my mind.
Arising.
Yeah.
Okay.
That blew my mind.
I mentioned the first two.
No, the example of the clock.
That analysis of what exists and what doesn't. Yeah, that's one of the different logical arguments you can use to try and prove what is a thing and what exists. And we're talking about how there's either one or there's more than one. We've got to try and see, and then there's relating to interdependence and interdependence. Okay, good.
So, on that topic,
yes,
that blew me away, and the closest I could get to it was, and you can correct me, of course, when my dad was, in the death process, I remember him laughing hysterically every time I said his name. So he had quite a long name, and he would just burst into hysterics, and I just got the feeling he had some wonderful kind of dementia, and I got, I agreed with him, it's totally absurd, his name business. So, because it was like he was laughing at the label, the label didn't exist, or that's how I took it, that's what I projected on it. So is that somewhere close to it? It's like the I is a bit like that. It's like...
I have no idea what your father's mind. I can't possibly tell.
No.
I can't even pretend to try and understand.
I mean, as an example.
I can't even imagine. Because you're telling me that the way your father responded is an example of how he must have understood there wasn't an I. I can't possibly. How can I say that? And how can you say that?
No. Would that be an analogy, though, that it's like a name? We name ourselves. We all
have names. That's not an analogy.
Right.
That's not. That would be a conclusion. In fact, the third level of dependent arising is that you cannot find among the parts not one atom of anything that resembles an independent I. So the conclusion is the subtlest level of dependent arising is that therefore the name is merely the label. That's a conclusion, not an analogy. That's a conclusion. That's the subtlest level of dependent arising, that there is nothing in this from the side of the cup or the self that makes it a cup of itself, because it's nothing other than the label coming from the mind that we impute upon the basis.
And is that what we're imputing on the basis of the parts by calling it I?
That's what I'm saying. I is the label we impute upon the valid base called these parts.
That's
and
okay.
That label is Rabina. The label we impute upon these parts is called cup.
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying.
Well, you didn't quite say it exactly, but you're in the right direction.
That's the right direction.
It's sort of like saying, well, 1 + 1 is sort of 2. I kind of think it's 2, roughly 2. I sort of mean 2. It's either 1 + 1 is 2 or it ain't. So you're on the right track, but it's not an analogy. It's, in fact, another way of saying how there is no intrinsic cup or I or anything else. And it's in referring to the subtlest level of dependent arising.
Yeah, because there is no intrinsic... Diane Louise Emery, that's
what?
My name.
Sorry, what?
Well,
Leave it right there. Just leave it there. Okay.
Good.
Leave it.
I did it.
Good. Thank you. What else?
Anything
else? Did you discuss emptiness over lunch? Did you try to find the eye? There's the eating and the eye that gets upset and the eye that gets happy. And the eye that goes to the toilet. There's a lovely story about Lamazoba Rinpoche, I always tell. He's a Sherpa, okay, that's why one of our things we do every year now, the last 2 weeks, this March and last March, Christina Ma, this young student of Rinpoche's in Sydney, she's led these treks we do, and I go, and some of us have done those treks up to Lamazoba, to the monastery up in the mountains. Lamazoba, when he was a meditator in his past life, and around which has now been established a bit of a monastery and a retreat centre is there. And so we've been going up there second year now, we're going again in March, and it raises money for the $500 of it, US dollars of it, goes to the monastery and for, upgrading things and fixing things and so on and so forth. And also for a long-term plan that Rinpoche has to build what they call a replica of Guru Rinpoche's Pure Land there. It's another whole thing. We're going to try and raise money for that to be seeing what he wants to do. So anyway, he was a Sherpa. He is a Sherpa. And as you might know, the Sherpas are mainly Tibetan Buddhists. They're kind of Tibetan racially, probably from hundreds of years ago, but they got their own language, their own styles, and many languages up there in the different parts of the mountains. But they're mainly so-called, Tibetan Buddhists. Some of them are Hindu. There are Hindus in Nepal, but also these Tibetan Buddhists. So they're the Sherpas generally are Tibetan Buddhists, and he's a Sherpa. So he was recognized as a little boy, but he's very tiny, as the reincarnation of a local meditator called the Lao Lama. He was what the local meditator. And he, Lao means, I always need to ask correctly, but it's either radishes or onions, I can't remember. And it seems that there's this so-called cave, little hole in the wall really, that this person known as Kunsang Yeshe, this is the past life, a layman, and a Nima, a yogi, a meditator. Like many of these laymen, they're sort of secret meditators. And especially as they get older, they then kind of retire to a cave and then meditate, you know, and then die and choose their next rebirth and keep on bopping, okay, on their spiritual path. Well, Kunsang Yeshe at some point found this hole in the wall where they used to store the radishes, and he kind of basically pulled the radishes out and moved in. So he got known as the Radish Lama, or the Onion Lama, whichever one is always forget. So the Lao Tzu Lama he's called. So anyway, he passed away, and then the way it goes, this whole business of reincarnation, when you really develop, you realize that you've got samadhi, the single point of concentration, you're realizing emptiness, you're able to do the unpacking, unraveling all the nonsense, and then you add the compassion wing to the mix, and you have this bodhicitta, which I'll talk about. It's got the wisdom wing and the compassion wing, and then they become these really remarkable beings who've got, you know, incredible realizations, gone beyond the ego, gone beyond the delusions, and have enormous compassion, and then choose consciously, life after life after life, to be reborn, even though they don't need to at some point, they finish the job, but out of their immense compassion to help others. This is the whole bodhisattva path. So he was one of those, it seems, this great yogi. So these yogis, especially the tantric yogis, the Vajrayana yogis, they've got all these realizations, and they're able to completely control their mind, also control the whole death process, and go through it and choose very consciously where they're going to get reborn. All of that fits with the Buddhist view of reality, okay? So this little boy, who's now known as Chuktan Zopa, Lama Zopa, I forget what his name was then, I forget. That was the name he got when he became a monk, I think, but I forget his birth name, I can't remember. But this is called a little Zopa. When I was up there, this last time, and the time before, I interviewed his sister. She's about 78 or something. She's been running the place for like 50 years, you know. Now her knees are completely destroyed because they walk up and down 1,000 times a day up these awful mountains, digging the potatoes and lugging the water. I mean, they live such incredible lives. And she's, she still runs the place. And her brother, who's younger than Lama Zopa as well, he is like the director, the manager of the centre, Lama Zopa appointed. So people go up there to do retreats and things. So we, you know, 32 of us went up this March, and then last year the same. We did a 5-day retreat, walking 4 days up there. And people love it. I was up in the mountains, you know. People love those little places. But being a city girl, I find it quite hard to love it. I see the mountains. I see the big mouth in the snow. It looks like really dramatic, you know. I look at it. I say, yes, this is amazing, isn't it? But I don't kind of feel anything. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude, but I think, yeah, it's a big mountain. I can see that. I'm more of a city girl. I'm more happy in like New York City or Sydney or something like that. I say I'm very happy about nature. I'm glad nature's there. I'm glad the trees and the mountains are there. I just don't need to see them, that's all. I don't mind seeing them, but it doesn't make me very excited, you know. As for walking as a choice to go somewhere, that I can't comprehend. I try to be polite, but I can't. I mean, I understand doing karate, that I like, but to walk as an exercise up a mountain as for pleasure, that is a bit much of my mind. So I try to be quiet, I try to comprehend it, but it's hard for me. But anyway, never mind. So I managed and was up there. So I was interviewing, because I was supposed to be doing Lama Zopa Rinpoche's biography, and then I was supposed to be for the last 3 years. I've been there hurrying because I'm getting old. I'm sort of thinking it over and mulling it over, but I can't quite work out where to go with it, so never mind, that's just my problem. But I started interviewing, so I interviewed his sister. She's talked before many times to other people. And she said that the time he was very tiny, when he was first born, even, from the time he could crawl. Even the time because they're dead, I mean, dead poor, these people, like dead poor, living in these little stone huts. And it's typical they all live in they live in the same place. The cow's down where mummy and daddy there, and the baby's there, you know. But even the time he was tiny, he always acted like a bit sort of hoity-toity, kind of sitting in a separate place. He would sit on a box and eat his meals on his own. Sort of somehow, like, different, you know. So the time he could crawl, every time mummy turned her back, Zopa's gone. They'd always find him, but there's this up the hill was this cave where this Lao Lama, the previous Lao Lama who died, used to meditate. And there was this path up there, and halfway up there's this little thing called a resting place where obviously when you're going up you sit there and have a sit in the rest, like, you know, a cup of tea or something with their thermoses. So like one of those, what do they call them in Australia? I love the term, convenience or something. What's the word we use for those stops on this on the way with the toilets there in?
Comfort stop.
What? Comfort. Yeah, that was American. Convenience or this weird word we use for convenience or I forget the words. Maybe it's comfort, I don't know. Anyway, whatever. It was just a little spot. They'd always find it was over there, crawl, you know, tucked, snuggled up asleep. So you'd always crawl up the mountain. You'd crawl up to this place. Every time she turned it back, they'd find him. And from the time he could walk and talk, he'd always insist that he was the louder lover. You know, he would act like a lover. He'd sit on his little box and make mud pie door ditties and mud pie bells and do little poojas. And then he would announce as he got older that his benefactors would be coming to the pooja. They'd be the names of his previous life benefactors. You know, that kind of thing. And then suddenly, when he could talk, and he'd be walking up the mountain, come home, no, say, that is my home. So this fits exactly with the Buddhist view, that as you progress spiritually and you get to a certain point where you literally do not lose anything, then you realize emptiness. You don't lose your memories, especially when you're a child. You can have crystal clear memory, and even now we can see in the West, so many children are remembering past life. Of course, we're cynical in our materialist world, but it's not uncommon. So the thing is, with them, not only do they remember the past life, but they actually choose their next life. They have such control over the whole process, you know. They just make a decision in advance where they don't get reborn. They kind of choose their womb and they book their womb in advance. So there's a little over, you know, do anything. And so the mummy has, so he was quite, she said she was six at the time, I think. She'd get so annoyed with him because he was difficult to, he was like strange behaviour, just different. And she'd always get annoyed, she always looked at his open, you know. So anyway, and he acted differently, the way things did things, whatever, whatever. So mummy thinks she figured she'd better check up on who he is. So she checks with the local lama, they do their divinations, and it comes up that it would seem he is the reincarnation of the Lao Lama. That's how they talk. So anyway, he was handed over to the monastery, which is what happens, and they're given a manager. I mean, it's very exciting, they call him a manager, literally. They manage, they're very professional, you know. Given a manager. So anyway, he was taken up to this mountain monastery, Rowaling, several hours beyond Lao. We didn't go there, because I didn't, some people did, I think. And there's a story that he told himself years later about how he nearly drowned. So this is the story, it's the one he told. So he said, there's this monastery, this manager, it was a big river. And then on the other side of the river, there were these weird looking people. He said, with straw coloured hair, pale eyes, but clearly white people. He'd never met white people before, so he wanted to meet them. So you don't go empty handed. So he had his bowl of potatoes, he was eight. That would have been about 1952, okay? So he'd never met white people up there. And he has a bowl of potatoes. He's walking, you know, with these bridges and what have you, they're really rigidy little bridges. They swing and move, you know, metal or ropes even. So he fell into water. But of course, they don't teach them swimming up there, so he's drowning. So this is how he told the story. He said, the head, we've discussed this, the head, not my head, was coming to the surface for air. So what you would have seen was a little boy looking like having a panic attack, gasping for air, right? He noticed his manager having a panic attack walking off, running on the bank, you know. So then as he's going down again, and the water's quite rough up there, and then he said something like this. He said, the thought occurred to me, the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama, not I, this is really, I'm going to talk about this after, the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama is about to die. And then he said, I didn't know anything about emptiness. And he meant by that in that life up till 8 years age, he's never heard the word yet. But there was no fear. So this fits exactly with the Buddhist view of the mind. And as we lessen delusions, and eventually radically lessen delusions by uprooting the main delusion, there is no fear. This seems so abstract to us. That's why I didn't hear this. Trying to understand the logic of this, taking the Buddhist model, it takes a while to put it together, I tell you. Because it's not how we think. So what it means is this. If you clearly we have to deduce he realized emptiness, and then you can't lose that. Which means there was none of that. So the sign that you're an ordinary person is that when you're attacked, a normal one, when you're attacked and offended, panic arises. This is what Mr. Darwin's instinct for survival, this analysis we give in science. Well, I would think that phrase, instinct for survival, is a really nice an equivalent of ego grasping, the root delusion. It's there all the time. But But it only rises strongly when someone offends you, insults you, nearly runs you over, hurts you. We know that. The fear, the panic arises, the fear, the powerful sense of I, you know, we have this. We recognize it. Mostly it's like a sleeping lion. And then we just experience the attachment and the anger and the jealousy, which are the symptoms of that ego grasping. So if we didn't have that, this is what's too shocking for us. We would have to deduce that there he is, seemingly struggling, would be, have to be, because he doesn't know how to swim, doesn't know how to navigate the water, coming up for air. But he would have looked like a little boy struggling, but his mind would have been calm. This is very weird for us. Because there was no ego grasping. Therefore no attachment, therefore no anger. So because when we hear that, and then because we assume that attachment, anger, grasping, all the rest are natural parts of an ordinary person, then this is where it's really hard for us to imagine how you would be if you didn't have those. It seems in our culture you'd be a mentally ill person. So it's very hard to understand it with you. The words are simple, but to really try and imagine what it would be like, literally not having ego grasping, literally not having any attachment and anger and jealousy and fears, is very hard to imagine. That's exactly how it would be. So therefore, even as he's drowning, he's struggling to survive, but his mind would have been clear. No fear. So now we think, with our model that assumes you've got to have anger, love, anger, depression, all the rubbish, and ego grasping, you need that sense of panic. You're like, oh my God, I'm drowning. And that gives you somehow the wisdom to know what to do. Otherwise, we assume if you don't have that response, you've got to sink to the bottom of the river like a stone and go, oh well, I'm drowning, what the hell? No. You're not stupid. You see you're drowning, and it's perfectly reasonable to want to breathe and do your best to survive. Doesn't need to have fear to do that. And doesn't need to come from attachment and grasping to do that. It comes from common sense and intelligence. It's really an interesting story for us. It's exactly with the Buddhist view of the mind, what we're capable of. So the interesting one was the head, the person known as the Lao Tzu. Because when we really learn to study this stuff in more depth and begin to get some experience of it, and when you really learn to debate it and use it and think it and meditate on it, and you get familiar with all the language, this is exactly the correct words. It is actually incorrect to say, I am Ravina. That's not correct. I am not Ravina. I'm the person known as Ravina. That's actually correct words. Because if I'm Ravina, it's like this whole business before, you know, if... Like a couple of the examples we posited, what is the I? It's the consciousness, it's intention, it's this, it's that, you know? So if, this is one of the arguments we have to show, we first established that the person is this is the phenomenon called person. That's a phenomenon called cup, let's say. So we just analyse the phenomenon called person, or self, or I, relatively speaking, conventionally. Then we have to define what that is, and that means we have to look, so that particular phenomenon has parts. So the name of the parts, to put down to two, are the body and the mind. So we can, so far so good. We have a body and we have a mind. We say, casually, I have a body, I have a mind. But if we analyse that statement, like I have a nose, a hand and a foot, then you're saying I as one phenomenon and hand as another phenomenon. I have a body and a mind. That's three phenomena. I have a body and a mind. I have body, mind. Three phenomena. But that's where we have to then see that that's a mistake. It's a mistake. Because if there were an I, a body, and a mind, you'd have to point out the body and you can point out the mind. They're separate. They're interdependent, but they're separate. And if you have to point out an I, it'd have to be a separate thing again. That's the point. And this is the analogy, the analysis we are doing. You can't. Well, it takes more than just this, but a meditator to get. So, then I am not Ravina. Because the other one was, either the I is oneness with or separate from. There's no two options. If there is an I, and this is the whole point about the meditation, and they go for years and years and years meditating, after you've done your logic and analysis and watch your practices, you then go to the mountains or wherever and learn to meditate on this at a deeper level in your mind with a single point of concentration to get the insight into how this is true. An insight at a subtler level. So, there's two options. The Buddha says, okay, I'm telling you there is no I, but don't just believe me, so you've got to go prove it. So he said, you've got to search for it. It sounds ridiculous, it's like a comic. Search for your eye, what hilarious, you know. They mean it literally. So that means you have to understand the words, the logic, the analysis, the conceptual level. When you utilize that in your meditation at an even more subtle level, and it gradually gets insight into it, by utilizing the thinking about dependent arising, we just gave one baby example. There's volumes of the different logical arguments you have to use in your meditation. First of all, your debates and then your meditation to prove there is no inherent I, there's no independent I. There's lots of these discussions and arguments you have to do. Then, when you're doing all that, and then, wait a minute, what happened? I've distracted myself again. Yeah, you have to then search. So the first thing you have to do, they say, Buddha tells us there's no inherent I, there's no independent I. But he says, don't just believe, you have to prove it to yourself, and that's perfect. You must prove it for yourself, you must acknowledge it, realize it for yourself. Einstein tells us it equals mc squared. Thanks, Einstein, we've got to prove it for ourselves. That's clear. That's the same here, to prove it for ourselves. So, there's only two options. First, you establish the parameters of your search. So here, this is the basis. You've got to establish the valid basis of that name. So the valid basis for cup is the valid basis for the label cup is the flat bottom clay container, isn't it? That's the valid basis. And it's the same analysis here as we do on the person. So the valid basis for the person known as Ravina is the body and the mind. They're the two parts of the person called Ravina. They're the two parts that make up the person called Ravina. So therefore, we have to look for an I, an independent I, among those. And there's only two options. There's either one that's with the body and the mind, or it's separate from. There's no other option. So the meditations consist of doing all the... This is where the two modes of meditation come in terms of emptiness. So the more you have, the more you train in your samadhi, the more you train in a single point of concentration, the subtler your mind goes, therefore the more capable your mind becomes. You get to single point of concentration, which is from not just following all the crazy thoughts, but you've got this amazingly, depending on whether you're 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, stage, whatever, then you've got this amazing level of clarity, of precise, focused clarity. A state of mind, to certainly be honest, even from the 3rd and 4th stages of this 9th stage, we don't even posit as existing in our psychology. We don't have such techniques. So you can't conceive of how amazingly capable the mind is at that level. You can effortlessly stay on that one object that you're focusing on, but equally you can effortlessly utilize this refined laser-like level of focus. You can kind of awaken it and use it to do very subtle, sophisticated analysis in the second mode of meditation in order to trigger the insight into emptiness. So Lama Yeshe puts it, dependent arising is the king of logics to prove emptiness. So the classic way of using these two modes of meditation, you go home, you do your concentration, you know, you get your focus, which you take with you, like you do with your 1+1 from your math teacher, and you go and do your homework so you can get insight into the meaning. It's the same here. You take whatever you've learned in your debate yard, all the stuff that you put up over the years, all your studies, all your this, all your that, all your logical analysis, which are in your mind, is conceptual, at the conceptual level. Then you have to transform those conceptual knowledge into experiential knowledge, don't you? Just like in music, the maths, and everything else. You learn the theoretical knowledge, you've got to be accurate, then you go home and you turn it into experiential knowledge by thinking it through, and then gradually as you think it through, the penny drops, doesn't it? If you practice and practice the piano, eventually that theoretical knowledge you had in your head now becomes experiential. Those theoretical concepts about or horticulture or math, in the beginning it's all these intellectual concepts, but as you go home and you do your homework, and then you start to practice in the garden, it becomes experiential knowledge. That's the thing here. So we have to have it go from intellectual knowledge to experiential. And these are the classic technical way you would do this. So you've done your debating and stuff, it's all rich in your mind, all these thoughts and concepts about emptiness. Then you go home and you sit down and get your concentration, depending on what level you've got, you'll get it as far as you can go. And now you go to the second mode, and now you utilize this laser-like focused level of mental capacity, utterly undistracted, super capable. And then you at this, and this can be at quite a subtle level, you can utilize it to think about at a really subtle level. Again, this does not exist in our psychology. Much more refined in the grosser level of conceptuality we have at the gross level, with all the scattered mind and all the distractions and everything, you know, not that. Super laser-like focus, super more powerful, more capable. So you utilize all the conceptual thoughts about things, just like the ones like all this we're doing, all the other logical arguments, is dependent, arising, whatever, and then you would think it through at this subtle level. And then at some point, the penny will drop. Oh, I get it. That's an insight. That's an insight. So what you do is in your meditation, you stop the analysis, you now have your focus on that insight, on the taste, the flavour, the insight, the penny dropping, the moment. You know, you focus on that. So the deeper your concentration is, the more you practice this, the deeper and longer you can stay tasting, holding, experiencing that insight. Until eventually one day you get to the subtlest level of your mind and you've thought about it and analyze it and meditate for a long time, eventually it becomes a direct, non-conceptual, experiential insight into this truth. And that's your first moment of genuine, direct experience of emptiness. From that second, you become what's called a superior being. From that second, you become an Arya being, superior being. And from that second, you're climbing out of your samsara into your nirvana. And from that second, you can't fall back. And if we have ego now, confusions and fears, we've never realized that one. So it's just comes with familiarity, familiarizing our mind with this. So dependent arising is all the conceptual way about the theories that you utilize to use in your meditation to think about in order to trigger the insight, which is exactly how you would learn 1 + 1 = 2. You hear it from your teacher, you take it home, you've got your little book in front of you. You get some focus, you close the door, you tell your brother to go out of the room, you try to concentrate, and now you go to the second mode and you take the information, 1 + 1 = 2. So that's got to be accurate information, doesn't it? You can't be vague. You've got to be able to know what 1 means, what plus means, what equals means, and what 2 means, intellectually. Then you think it through in your second mode of meditation. But the goal is to get insight. So you use the theory with your concentration to think about it, and it's the thinking about it in concentration, in a concentrated state, that triggers the insight. At some point you use your blocks and you write it out and you go, oh mummy, I get it. That's your insight. You just realize that 1 + 1 = 2. So you've got to have the valid knowledge. You can think about 1 + 1 = 3 to 47 years and you never come true because it's not true. You've got to have the right information, you've got to have the right words, so you can think it through. And thinking through is just like vaguely thinking about it. 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1. You've got to use your noggin, and that triggers the taste of it, and that you keep perfecting that until it becomes second nature. That's how you realize emptiness. This is how you become enlightened. Same person. So let's take another tack. Because one of the big confusions, we read all the literature, we're trying to practice, and we read it all, we study it, and we get so confused about the actual word, emptiness. We hear the shorthand, you've got to realize emptiness. And then the ideas that come up in some of the dumb, stupid, wrong literature, the ideas we can even imagine about what that means is just beyond idiocy, you know. So confused. Because we don't use these kind of negating concepts, it's just onto us. Even it's kind of almost considered some kind of equivalent to the absolute, or equivalent to God, or just these weird, wacky ideas that people have. Just look at that word, how it's used. What does it mean in just use of the words? Forget the meaning, but the meaning even of the use of the words, realize, thank you. Shorthand. Okay. In ordinary life, we use these words, don't we? We say, oh, my cup's empty. We know it means there is no tea left in my cup. So the assumption is, I expected tea, didn't I? I mean, you've got a shop full of cups in the shops, don't you? They're all empty, aren't they? But you don't say there's an empty cup because you don't expect tea to be there. But if you expect tea to be there, you get a surprise. Oh, my cup's empty. Don't we do that? Don't we do that? It's clear, isn't it? My cup's empty. You look in the bank. Oh, God, my bank's empty. You know, these are dollars. These are boring emptinesses. You know, you want your tea and it's not there. You want your money and it's not there. You're not happy about those emptinesses, but the concept is what I'm trying to get our heads around. We talk like this. So that means there is something that does exist, a cup, that lacks something else, tea. So now, Buddha says, everything is empty. Whatever you posit as existing conventionally is necessarily empty. So let's spell it out a bit more. Empty of what? Not people. You say a room is empty, isn't it? Not people, not dollars, and not tea, I promise. Basically, he's saying, everything that does exist conventionally, and even that's tricky because we all overstate even what exists conventionally. But whatever does exist conventionally, whatever we can establish as existing conventionally, cups and toilets and people and cushions, are empty of a particular way of existing which they don't possess, which is inherent existence, independent existence. All synonyms in the literature you'll see, you know, that there is, well, the way to say it is, you know, so the I, cup, microphone, are empty of existing from their own side, of existing independently, of existing inherently, of existing in and of themselves. These are the synonyms. Clearly you've got to study that to get remember them all, because they're just weird, wacko ideas to us. They're all synonyms. Everything is empty of existing from its own side. Everything is empty of an independent existence. Everything is empty. And that's how they say it. So the I, you posit the conventional I, the person known as Rabina. Then we do the analysis among the parts, etc., etc. And we will discover that we won't find an independent I. And another way to put that is, therefore, Rabina is empty of existing from her own side. Rabina is empty of existing as an intrinsic person. That's the way they talk. So, I was just saying example. So I'll use the example about, let's say, Kathy has a bank account. Right. No, another type of example. She thinks she's got cancer. She believes she's got cancer. Or even she's got cancer. So she has cancer. And she's, you know, and she just believes she's got cancer. She knows she's got cancer. She's been told she's got cancer. She's got cancer. That's not a happy story. We don't want cancer, do we? That's pretty clear. You believe you've got cancer. Totally believe you've got cancer. You've been treated as if you've got cancer. You're in the hospital and you're seen as a dying person. And people say, oh, Kathy's dying. She's got cancer. And the whole concept we have around that one. And then she does her tests, and they tell her, there's no cancer there, Kathy. Well, she'd be a bit surprised, wouldn't she? And she'd be a bit delighted, wouldn't she? So what we can say is this, that Kathy, That's right. So we would say then, Kathy just realised the absence of cancer, didn't she? She was informed that she didn't have cancer. She believed she had cancer. She expected cancer. She knows she's got cancer. She's preparing for cancer. She's, you know, but suddenly the doctor says there's no cancer. She'll be quite shocked but delighted. So what she just realized is the absence of cancer. Can you hear those words? The absence. So the word lack, the word not, the word absent, and the word empty are all the same meaning. There is no tea in my cup. My cup lacks tea. It's another way to put it, it's not a fancy way to put it. My cup is empty of tea. Empty is simply the use of ordinary use of it. Not the philosophical meaning of it. Is the use of it simply means there isn't tea there. There isn't cancer there. So we would say Kathy has just realized the emptiness of cancer. Would you accept that? Can you hear the words? It's kind of a funny way to put it. If you think there's money in your bank And she opens the bank account and she sees, you know, she thinks it's $5,000 there, but she sees it not $0 there. She will just, you know, this is a more complicated one. No, I'll say it a different way. Let's say there's $72 there. She at that moment she looks at the bank and says, oh my God, where's my $5,000? She just realized the absence of $5,000. Can you hear that? It's a very funny way to put it, but it's got a powerful meaning here. She just realized the absence of what she thought was there. She just realized the absence of the cancer, which she thought was there. If I'm believing my tea again, I go, oh! I just realized the absence of tea in my cup. So when you realize the absence of something, it means here that, I mean, there's no elephant in this room, right? But we're not expecting there an elephant to be in the room. So you can't, there's no point saying we just realized the emptiness of an elephant in this room. There isn't an elephant. And it's true that we do discover the absence, but we never thought there was in the first place. We don't waste time thinking about it. So the whole point here, the dynamic is, when you realize the absence of cancer, the only person who realizes the absence of cancer is the person who thinks there was cancer there. If I don't think she's got cancer, I won't be surprised if I discover she's got no cancer. Well, I didn't think she had it anyway. Could you sort of hear that? If I don't expect $5,000 in the bank, I'll just see the truth, it's naught. If I don't expect cash, I'll just see healthy Kathy. If I don't expect tea, I'll just see a nice cup. So the whole dynamic here is, and that's why they always talk about the realization of it is so shocking. And why the word is so, why it's so important to hear it in this negating way. So one more piece to add to this. It seems that when the mind does its job of cognizing things. Okay, when you study Buddhist philosophy, you learn, in one of the first texts you study, you learn all the nuts and bolts of different terminology that's used and the structure of the worldview. So one of the first things is you discover that the universe consists of various phenomena. And which, as Buddhist dealers, we're trying to discover the reality of all phenomena, so we're going to start breaking down the phenomena. So there's like six synonyms, I forget now, six or seven or five, I can't remember, for the word phenomenon. Phenomenon, object of knowledge, object, existent, established base. These are all synonyms for that which exists. So the whole deal here, the relationship between that which exists and the mind is absolute for the Buddha, because everything is made by the mind. Over countless eons, our minds, he literally create realities, create by all these conceptual stories we have. So the mind is absolutely central in relation to discovering what is real and what is not. So, even the definition of an existent, one of the synonyms, is that which can be cognized by the mind. Clearly a valid state of mind. So it's axiomatic for the Buddha that that which is cognized by a valid state of mind is that which exists. And that which exists is that which can be cognized by mind. So mind is central in the discovery of reality of the whole universe. So the mind cognizes that which exists. And Buddha's saying that right now, having all these delusions in our mind that pollute our mind, they prevent us from seeing in reality exactly what does exist. They add on top of what exists things that don't exist. That's why we suffer, he says. It's not just some intellectual, interesting, philosophical view. The experiential implication of this is that this is why we suffer. So the experiential implication of using our noggins in this way and trying to understand the way reality is because that will stop you from suffering. Whereas it's very interesting, if we think in the West, you can get bucket loads of knowledge, you can be a genius mathematician, have masses of wisdom. But you go home and beat up your husband every day. It doesn't touch your heart. It has nothing to do with ethics. And whereas the Buddhist view, wisdom comes with ethics, it can't not. And wisdom brings happiness, ignorance brings suffering. Not in a vague emotional sense, but in a literal sense. And this is the way we unpack the mind in Buddhism. So the word, yeah, so what the mind always, when the mind cognizes something, they talk about the mind as the subject and what it cognizes is the object. So whatever the mind, so eye consciousness. This is where one really wants to help even prove emptiness, you know. When we talk about, I might have done this, I can't remember. I've done it many times before. We say, oh, it was a pretty cup, you know. No, Buddha says, your eye consciousness can only cognize, the sensory consciousness, Buddha says, is very limited in its capacity for cognition. In reality, eye consciousness can only cognize two things, shape and color, that's it. There's another way they do talk, but never mind, keep it simple here. So the object of eye consciousness is not to cut the silly idea. The object of eye consciousness is shape and colour. So what then you have to ask, what part of my mind cognizes a pretty cup? We've got sensory consciousness and we have mental consciousness. And mental consciousness, that's where the workshop is. That's what we have to comprehend. That's all the causes of happiness, causes of suffering, all our dramas, all the good, all the bad, all the intelligence, all the joy, all the happiness, all our memories, all there. That's where the workshop is, as Lundgren says. So a pretty cup is a conceptual story stored in my consciousness that I've made up about that shape and colour. So, there's an extra piece there. So whatever the mind cognizes is necessarily an object of knowledge. Object doesn't mean physical, it means that which mind cognizes. So whatever the mind, so almost it's like the mind always cognizes a noun. And I'm just saying that, okay? So, you know, blue. My eye consciousness cognizes blue. My ear consciousness cognizes sound. There's always an object that the mind cognizes. Different levels, different states of mind. So, when Kathy looks in her bank, expecting $5,000, believing in $5,000, anticipating $5,000. When she sees $72 or $0, either way, doesn't matter. She won't notice the truth. She won't cognize the truth, the presence of $0. She will get the shock of her life and she will cognize the phenomenon called the absence of $5,000. When she gets to hear the doctor, and this is a lovely agent to discover, she will suddenly have an insight. The moment he says it, she'll get this incredible direct insight of, she'll have a realization that second that she hears those words. It'll trigger this massive realization of the absence of cancer. That's called the emptiness of cancer. It's not going to be abstract, but it's vivid in that sense. It's not just, it's vivid because the more she's expecting it, the more she believes it, the more dread she has of cancer, the more liberated and the more blissful and radiant she'll be when she discovers the absence of cancer. Okay, she's depressed when she sees the absence of $5,000, but the logic is the same. It's trying to get her head around the use of the idea of the absence of something, which is, it is indeed abstract, it is indeed negating, but it's crucial that we understand it. We do realize the absence of tea, but we just don't say it like that. So, in your meditation, or conceptually, when you really have an insight into it, you conceptually do all this logical analysis to try and get to disprove ego grasping's nonsense story that there is an independent I in here. You're using logic to argue with that misconception from all many, many angles to chip away at that misconception, to chip away at that misconception. And then when you've got concentration, and you've been meditating many times on it, and you go into your subtle concentration, you go to your second mode, you do your analysis, at ever more subtle level, ever more subtle level, ever more subtle level. And then one day, you have little moments of insight, it grows. You don't suddenly go from being playing no music to being Bach overnight. It's an evolution, isn't it? Same here. So at some point, it'll be at the subtle level of your mind. You can't do this out of shamatha. You can't do this without subtle concentration, not possible. You can get flashes of it, but it's only a genuine insight when your mind is non-conceptual at a subtle level. And you'll have your first moment of your non-conceptual, direct, experiential insight into the reality that there, in fact, here, there never has been, isn't, and never could be, an independent self. So these examples, she could have cancer, there could be water there, there could be money in the bank. But this absence is a much more radical absence. The Buddhists say an independent I, an independent cup, an independent anything cannot exist. It is an impossibility. But that's what ego grasping utterly and completely and totally and all-consumingly believes in. And on the basis of this, for countless lives, we have attachment and grasping and all the dramas and rebirth, 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 until eventually the penny drops. And you realize this powerful recognition of the absence of that fantasy I. And Lama says, the really great yogis have such bliss when they finally realize they have cancer, but a billion times more exciting. When they finally realize the independent eye, that in believing and grasping at and acting upon for countless eons, has never, doesn't, and could never exist. So it's not as if you throw, like in her case, she did have cancer, so she threw out the cancer. In her case, there was $5,000, but now there isn't. And in this case, there was chi, and now there isn't. But this one, there never was an independent eye, because there can't be. So this, the realization of this absence is a billion times more powerful. Can you hear what I'm saying to you? It's the use of the language. So it's not just some abstract idea, there is no. And that's the other one. The biggest misconception we get when we hear all these teachings, when we hear there is no independent eye here, naturally we're hearing it literally, oh, well, there's no eye. And then one of the commonest misconceptions about emptiness, well, everything's empty anyway, it doesn't matter. This is instantly misconception, instantly wrong view, totally wrong view, complete misconception. You just threw the baby out in the bathwater. It's a lovely analogy for nihilism. You threw out too much. And that's why this Tsongkhapa's approach to the two truths, conventional reality and ultimate. Conventional reality is how things exist in a dependent sense, interdependently, and ultimate reality is how they don't exist. So these two seemingly opposite. And right now he says we have these two wrong views deep in our bones. So as soon as we hear the word there is no I from its own side, there is no intermediate I, there is no I in and of itself, there's not one atom of an I from the side of the I, we can't help but hear there is no I completely and then chuck the baby out of the bathwater and become nihilistic. That's the commonest misconception, and it's quite nuanced and hard to even intellectually hear the difference, you know. So I'll put it like this, an interesting analogy. Just use the bank account again. So let's say the reality is there's $0. Let's say the reality is $0. But she expects 5,000. So when she goes into the bank account and sees the naught there, the overriding realization she will have is she doesn't realize the object that she just realizes when she opens her bank is not, oh, no dollars, what the hell? No, it's the absence of her precious $5,000. So if I look at the bank, I would say zero. So listen to this now. The object, so what's the object called that Kathy realizes? Absence of $5,000. And then the object I realize is $0. Can you hear how they're completely separate phenomena? Can you hear how they're different phenomena, aren't they? That's why there being no inherent I here does not mean there's no I. That's not nihilism. It doesn't mean you chuck out all the pieces and there's nothing left. You look in here for an eye, oh, there's nothing there, there's no I, it's all empty, might as well die. Completely well meaning. It takes a while to understand this, you know. Because in reality, when we do this in the framework of dependent arising, this is why Tsongkhapa teaches us, you can never lose the plot. You can never fall into the abyss of the great mistake, he says, which is linked to the one of depression and there's nothing. That's why we have to kill ourselves. There's no I, there's no meaning, there's no life, there's nothing. That's how materialist world is. It is nihilism. There's nothing. It's living, you're dying, you're a bunch of flesh, you know. It's interesting. The other extreme, they call it the view of eternalism. And this would be expressed in the philosophical teachings of the creator. It's interesting. Or the self. There is something there that's intrinsic and special. The Greeks call it like an essence. The Christians call it a soul. The Hindus call it a self. There's something there subtle and essential that's concrete, that's solid, that's independent, that is somehow the meaning of me. There's something there you can locate. Buddha says that's one extreme. You're over-exaggerating the status of the I. And then the other one, you chuck everything out and become nihilistic, and you're under-exaggerating the status of the I. They're both extremes. And if you like to think about it this way, this one really is the view of attachment. This is the view of depression. And I mean this sincerely. Because we have this grasping of a pathetic me, then when it doesn't get what it wants, we just end up becoming depressed and completely want to kill ourselves, like nihilism. There's nothing, and life is not worthwhile. And when we get everything exciting and gorgeous, we're all excited and perky, the cat is getting what it wants. In both cases, they're an expression of ego grasping's view of there being something special and unique and blah, 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 cute and lovely and the meaning of things, and here is nothingness. These are the two extremes. The middle way is in between the reality of the two truths. So on the face of it, we hear was not a single thing in the eye that makes it the eye. We think, oh, well, there's no eye, so they have bath water. Then we see dependent, then we hear dependent arising, there is an eye that does exist in dependence upon causes, parts, and finally the name imputed. And then we hear that there is an eye that is dependent, then we over exaggerate it, we reify it, we go, oh, phew, what a relief, there's something after all, grass. So we go between these two constantly. So by lessening attachment and aversion, we lessen that grasping. So the real one is when we think about dependent arising, that there is an eye that does exist dependent upon this and that, we have to remind ourselves that means there is no eye from its own side. So dependent arising infers emptiness. And every time we hear there is no independent eye, instead of falling over the abyss of the great mistake or falling into throwing the baby out the bathwater, oh, there's no eye anyway, you consciously say there being no inherent eye means there is an interdependent eye. You've got to practice thinking this, then you can never lose the plot of it. You're on the right track. This takes time, because study it, think about it, and experientially apply it every day. And it brings the mind to be very stable. And it lessens attachment, lessens aversion, lessens all the dramas, you know. Stay steady. Speaking to you, Jenny? Any more questions? So, as long as I was there.
What one?
Yes, Jen. Microphone covered. The problem is that a wireless microphone would be much less funky, wouldn't it?
I'll tell Andy that.
Tell Andy that, yeah. Go on.
What do you think is the relationship between what seems to be the inherently existent I, this solid, real me, and the idea of free will?
Well, let's look at that. We have to give us due respect. We use that in the world today as some kind of scientific finding. But with respect to it, just to put it in its correct context, that's a teaching of Jesus Christ. Okay? I don't know what Jews say, or the Muslims, but it's not a scientific finding. It's certainly a Buddhist teaching. I'm not being rude about it. It is coming from Jesus Christ. It's coming from the Christian teaching. But God made you perfect, then gives you this ability to choose, and then you now make your choices. But the phrase is very fascinating. The phrase free will, for me, is an amazing way we have to unpack that. Why would I say free will? I don't know. It's just coming from Christians. You just say the ability to choose is much more valid. But we don't. We say free will. So that free will seems to me, not dependent on anything. Literally existing in isolation. Everybody's got the decision. So, you know, if you had that view that God made you and gave you free will, then you know that's when you have that view. You see the smelly old homeless person. Ah, they're just lazy. They're just chosen to be homeless. So if you really analyze that, I think even on the level of called free will, it's like a joke. When was the last time somebody chose to be depressed? Excuse me, it's a joke, isn't it? When did you choose to get angry? When did you choose to be jealous? We don't choose it. We just run like a magnet towards it. Forget about choice. It's going to be a joke of the whole world, isn't it? So it's almost anonymous anyway. And you'll think it's free. So choice, yes. But it's dependent arising. So, in other words, do I have the ability to choose to play piano? Do I have the ability to choose? Do I have the ability to choose to play piano? I do, don't I?
Well, it depends.
No, wait. I do have the ability. In theory, I have the ability to say, "I will play piano." It's true. I can say the words, "I will play piano." But to actually the ability to play the piano, it depends on the piano, a teacher, and the capacity. If I'm tone deaf, I'm sorry. I can want to play the piano till the cows come home. I won't get it clear. So it's a dependent arising. So yes, we all do have the ability to choose, but it's the ability to do it is dependent arising. It depends on the tendency. So for example, it's so clear. Does a lot, you know, that's why they talk about lions, don't, not animals don't have free will. It's a good way of putting it. So another way of saying the Buddhist view is we all, the virtuous states of mind are the ability to make choices. That's a good way to put it. But to say free, which implies not dependent, it's an absolute. It's clearly, it's nonsense. You know, if I spent my life being angry, even before I was a Buddhist, you tell me that I could choose to be patient. First, I wouldn't be able to hear you, but second, I'd be stupid. So I thought anger was a great thing. So I didn't have any ability to be angry. So it's only when you start to think about it, you go into it and think about it, and then in order for even me to think about it, I have to have a tendency in my mind, an ability to even comprehend the meaning of patience. So okay, I have Nick Rebush, you know Nick, our friend Nick, he lives in Boston, he's Australian, and then one of the practices, as you might know, lots of Buddhists do, you know, certain. You know, you go and save animals. They live in Boston, so they're near Maine. So Maine is where they do all kill the lobsters. So they go and on certain days in the Tibetan calendar, you go to Maine and you buy up all the lobsters. You save lobsters from death, from being boiled in water, right? Which is a very nice action. Then you release the lobsters. Well, that's, you know, it's marvelous to release even an ant from something. It's fantastic. So what happens is they happen to get on the news, or the telly, how these Buddhist groups goes every year and saves a bunch of lobsters. Well, the lobster fishermen heard about it, and they were completely offended. So, my point is this. I'll finish the story in a minute, so I'll give another example. A woman I met at Chen Raising Institute in Queensland, she came to the teachings and she told me how she'd been married to a fisherman, she fell in love with a fisherman, so she helped him run his business, she was killing fish. And then one day, often would go out with a girlfriend, they go out deep sea fishing, get these big kind of fish while they're in the deep sea. So she'd never forget one day, they pulled up this big fish, you know, and came to the boat, all happy. Then suddenly another big fish reared up into the water and looked like encircled the boat and looked to her like it was the husband or the wife of the fish and looking into the boat frantically. She stopped fishing for that second. So now, what I'm getting at is this. We can deduce that she had a tendency to not kill. It was triggered by that event. But if she never was able to access that tendency, she would have just kept on fishing. The lobster fisherman did that. So someone else would hear that story on the television and be very moved with compassion at the thought of these people who saved all the lobsters. Because they had a tendency, and it was the first time they'd heard the idea, and they could be, wow, I must never eat lobsters again. That's so terrible. How marvelous these people. So they'd have to have a tendency, wouldn't they?
Yes.
So they have the ability to choose to not eat lobsters now, they've just got compassion. But those fishermen, they heard about it and they were really insulted. They called the television station, they went out and they caught exactly the same number of lobsters, and they're going to show those bloody Buddhists insulting our profession. So not only did their seeing, killing, hearing about someone saving lobsters not give them compassion, it increased their wish to kill. So they didn't have any such thing as free will to stop killing. What a joke. Because there wasn't a tendency they could access in their mind. So it's a dependent arising. And the first one is to have a tendency right there. Then you can choose, yes. In other words, free will sounds like an absolute choice. There's no such thing as existence. Everything is dependent on arising.
Yes.
And the more we understand karma, the more we understand dependent arising, because it's an example of dependent arising, then the more we can understand how not only does karma deny the ability to choose, which is the first thing we ever hear, it affirms choice. It affirms it. But the key understanding is one of dependent arising. Cause and effect is an example of dependent arising. That's the crucial teaching in Buddhist philosophy. So at a certain point I would have heard, be patient, I would have laughed at it. But later, and I began to hear the Buddhist teaching, then my mind was ready for it. So I was able to know that I could choose. But even then, it took me years. I remember it took me years to be able to put it into practice. We all know you have a theory first, but you keep failing, don't you? So I remember almost the first time, it was years after I became a Buddhist. when it became real to me that I could change. Before that, I just thought anger was my middle name. And I felt so despairing, I keep falling back into the old habit. And that's always the disconnect we have, is that you know the theories, but it takes a while for it to become experiential. That's why we just have to keep practicing and never giving up. It's a false expectation. I think you'll stop being angry overnight. As if you're going to play bark overnight. As if the oak tree will grow overnight. It's an incremental, gradual process. But you just want to know about that, so we kind of beat ourselves up because we're so hopeless. This wrong understanding. And I remember the moment when I began, for the first time, it made sense to me that I can change. So keep persevering, keep working at it. Yeah, okay.
I'll wait for the microphone.
Good. Yeah.
Rabina. The intellectual knowledge, so where you understand something, and then that journey to experiential. The experiential, the experience of something, is that the insight?
Yeah, it's all time in, that's all it is. It's the word insight. And it's a great word in English, isn't it? Insight, yeah. Inner seeing. Of course, absolutely.
When you have that inner seeing, you're experiencing whatever.
Yeah, but whatever. It's not perfect, right? You've got to practice it. But it can be always the first moment, for the first time when you understand what this one is too. The first time you get it, that you don't have to be angry all the time. So there's a gradual process, that you keep practicing. There's the first time at some point when you can play that piano piece in grade one. And that's, you get the insight, and then you just keep practicing. It's an organic, ongoing, incremental. And the thing is, we understand it when it's intellectual knowledge. We don't apply that to our own emotions. That's why we're so brutal to ourselves. I've been practicing for 20 years, I still get angry. Well, the mistake isn't you still get angry. The mistake is the assumption you shouldn't be, that you should be better than you are, because you're not realising your progress. Are you hearing me?
I am.
Good. Yes. I mean, there's insight, there's gradual insights, and then what we're talking here, which is a bit abstract for us, in the subtle meditation, when there's the first moment exactly when it becomes a direct, non-conceptual insight. That's when it's a genuine insight, when the root is cut. Ego grasping is cut for the first time then, experientially. There's that insight, which is much more dramatic than the conceptual insight, but it's an ongoing process. There are insights we get from listening, there are insights we get from thinking about it, and there are insights we get as part of our progress, isn't it? But there is a very distinct moment called the direct non-conceptual insight into emptiness. That's when it's definite, the real one that you can't fall back on. That is really intellectual. Do you understand?
So there's encouragement along the way, really, in that respect.
Oh, God, the Mother of Jesus in heaven. What else is it but the total most amazing encouragement on the planet?
It is extremely encouraging. That's why I come back and listen to you.
Good friend. Oh, that's why I have that lovely issue. You know, I'd go to this issue when I was over my first course, and I'd be sitting in there just despairing, what the hell is he talking about? And all about kind of all this overwhelming misery. And then Lama used to come along and I think, thank God, it makes sense, you know. Lama always was able to say, just kind of make you feel lighter and more optimistic as possible. It was possible whenever he talked. It was such a relief. Yeah, that's the point for him. What else did he So for the other whole approach, we look at the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. The compassion wing is the point, really, to help others. It's incredible. Amazing to think this. But all the Buddha's saying is, that's true, but as the Dalai Lama says, compassion is not enough. You've got to have wisdom, and that what that means here is what we're talking about in this room. The nuts and bolts of your own neuroses and fears and lessening those, and that allows your goodness to grow, in a sense. So what holds us back, I'll give these examples. If we're overwhelmed by our own attachment for things to be lovely, we don't name it so brutally that that's what it is, and don't put yourself down for it, but that's why we suffer. Then aversion arises, panic arises, fear arises, anxiety arises when it doesn't get what it wants. When she talks to her mummy and discovers the pain, the hurt, the grief, the suffering, and she's feeling hopeless, what can I do? So of course we have panic and can't bear it. So that to that degree that we have attachment and aversion is to that degree your compassion is limited. So the work of the wisdom wing is all the is the work of you working on your mind. You are the beneficiary of this. So the emphasis in all of that practice, you know, when you talk about different levels of vows, this first level that relate to this first level of practice, the wisdom wing, are the vows. All this whole level of practice is called the practice of the morality or the ethics of restraint. You're refraining from killing. You're refraining from lying. It's the whole thing of don't. It sounds kind of passive. Don't kill. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't badmouth. Don't this. But it's profound. Because you're programming your mind in a different way. You're using your mental discipline to work on your body and your speech, which at least prevents you from harming others, which then begins to harness your own energy. It's huge. But it's the morality of restraint. So as you progress on just this practice, lessening delusions, lessening your body and speech and controlling your mind, lessening your delusions, the result of what I keep saying is you become more stable, more content, more fulfilled, literally, more happy, more balanced, more disciplined, more grown up. You are the direct beneficiary of this practice. But of course, because you live in a world that affects others, as Lama Zopa says, the rats and the cockroaches all have a party because you leave them in peace. But your job in this first level of morality isn't to proactively help the rats and the cockroaches, it's to stop harming them. That's pretty good already. So I remember hearing about in Maine, where else they have deer? Vermont. Because they have deer shooting season, as you know. So there's some people there don't let the shooting happen. So the deer know, this whole one power in one place, all the deer come from the other property and come to the property where you don't get killed. They know, but they don't get killed. No problem. They know they'll be protected there. So anyway, this whole first level of practice is emphasis on yourself and controlling your body, controlling your speech, and controlling your mind. And that includes, first level, controlling your body and speech, and then junior high school is getting concentration and starting to become your own therapist. This is stupendous. You become an astonishing person. So the byproduct of this is others will benefit, but it's not proactively benefiting others yet. It's the byproduct. You're the direct beneficiary. Now you could argue you're more qualified to go to proactively benefit others because your little old ego is getting out of the bloody way now. And you can see others more clearly because you've lessened your own neuroses. And then you can now compassionately, proactively practice the ethics and morality of actively benefiting others. It's a really precise meaning. It's very logical. If you've been running around harming and sending beings all day and night, and you stop doing that first, then you learn how to be an acupuncturist. And now you can actively benefit them. You've got a skill to actually help them. Well, even here, just the more you work on your own mind, the less. So in other words, all these delusions, speaking from the perspective of helping others, they're the things that are in the way that block us from seeing others clearly. From our own point of view, they're the things that cause me to suffer, but they're the things that block me from seeing others. Now this is kind of evident. Like I said before, let's just forget whether you're a pedophile. Just think that you're attached to food, seriously attached to food. You know yourself, if you're here in your mind, and you really are hungry, or you know, like, you're hungry, and the person's talking and talking and talking to you. You just wish they would be quiet, almost your bloody meal, you know? I mean, it's so, but we don't even like to see that because we don't want to sound like we're being selfish. But it's just natural. Imagine if you're an alcoholic. You don't even want to listen to anybody else because you're so frantic in your own needs. That's the suffering of attachment. And it's so much his own drive to get your own things. You want your peace, you want your use, you want your coffee, you want your tea, you want your cake. You know, we're happy to be kind to people, but I'm sorry, we've got a very short leash on kindness. Because as soon as it interferes with my needs, instead of thinking you're a mean person, this is just how we all are. Then you're very limited in your wish to be kind, even your own precious baby whom you adore. You've got to have a drink, you've got to have your meal, you've got to have your this, you've got to have your sleep. I mean, that's normal, of course, but we can see that the presence of my neediness, which is my attachment, blocks me from really helping others, or helping others too much, you know? A little bit fine, but that's enough, back off, you know? So can you imagine if you're driven by the most intense attachment to want to harm others? A bad enough to be attached to cake. Cake doesn't mind if you shove it in. You're the one who suffers from that. But suffering in human beings, harming human beings on the basis of attachment, that is beyond heavy. But when you understand the drive of attachment and the torment of it in our own mind, not just live in denial of it, just think it's natural, then you really own your own neuroses. Then you can see how that level of your pathetic old neuroses and wanting hate or it, this or that or whatever prevents you from helping others. But if you have such an intense attachment, you know, like sexual attachment, and then you use it to harm others, then you can see how heavy attachment is. How heavy. Without being negative to ourselves, it should break our hearts, because that's why we suffer. And that's why until we've done the wisdom wing and deeply understand our own mind and our own pain and our own suffering, and really have compassion for ourselves, which causes us to want to give it up, until then we can't really have compassion for many sentient beings. Only for a few innocent victims. Yeah. Only when I know my mind, then I can understand others. And we're all in the same boat for this reason. We're all in the same boat. I always think of Mr. Trump, such a vivid example. You know, of course, all the American press. I mean, they're all up there with subscriptions by 10,000 because of Mr. Trump. The Time, New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, all the papers. They want to increase their subscriptions. All the people who want to have good press, you know. Over Mr. Trump, every second story of Mr. Trump, the opinion pages, the front pages, the second pages, they're all Mr. Trump, especially now I'm going to be following all the court cases coming out. And finally, he's now been, you know, they're going to slaughter him. I mean, and also it's kind of been, whatever. So I can imagine, and read this, when I read the papers, this is the wisdom wing approach to life, you know. I read the papers, and I read plenty of papers. I read Mr. Trump. I don't go and look at that monster and say, oh, this evil person, how dare he, blah, 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 blah. And all these goody-goodies, I mean, as you can see, in a way, the goody-goody liberal ones, all vindictively trying to get the best lawyers and the best things to rip the man to pieces, you know. Because one lawyer said, you can find injustice anywhere. You can, every one of those politicians, they can all be ripped to pieces in a court of law. But just, you know, you use all, it's like when Mr. Clinton was around, and remember Mr. Starr did all that business, and all the supporters of Mr. Clinton said it's a witch hunt. That's exactly the same as Mr. Trump, and it is a witch hunt. You get my point? Is it a witch hunt? Because everyone's bad, everyone's rubbish. But Mr. Trump, what I'm getting at here, the wisdom wing is, I just have to look and listen. I go, this, I recognise stealing, I recognise hubris, I recognise arrogance, I recognise, I mean, he's unbelievable arrogance all these years, and the hubris of believing he can get away with all this garbage, you know. I recognise pride, I recognise anger. So every one of those things I know in my own mind. So I can only imagine the torture of Mr. Trump's mind, sitting in his utter misery, being cornered now, finally. Are you hearing me, people? How can I say that if I don't know it myself? So instead of, Mr. Trump, this evil monster, this devil from hell, like as if I'm some kind of saint, which is how we all do it. We all think we're so pure and clean, we're so holy, we're so perfect, and he's this monster. We love to have innocent victims and monsters. And they both go together. You can't have an innocent victim without a monster. And you can't have a monster without an innocent victim. And that's our demented, insane dualism in our world, you know. Like as if I'm so pure. How dare we? So when I know my own mind, I tick off all those, I can know Mr. Trump's mind. Yeah, you've got to get his comeuppance. It's his problem. I recognize that, I say to myself. Then I can afford to have compassion, and that doesn't mean he's a poor Mr. Trump can't help it. No, of course I have compassion for him. I know how he feels. But he's going to have to get the results of his own actions, and that's, you know, but you don't get angry about it. You don't delight in it, which is what happens. We delight in it. I'm so glad I've got Mr. Trump. That's evil. That takes time, though. So compassion isn't just being sentimental. Poor thing, can't help it. And that's why we think only compassion for victims. That's usually a few children and a few animals. That's about it in our culture. So compassion wing is contingent on the wisdom wing. So the more you get understanding your own delusions, the more happy you become, the more clean you become, the more compassionate you become. It's incremental, you know. So when you understand the Buddhist teachings, that it is incremental, it's kind of gradual, incremental. The more you know where the different levels of practice are, the more you're clear about the different ones. So in other words, in one day, in a relationship, let's say, I might just refrain from saying those bad words. That's junior school practice, control your speech. Best I can do. Next level of practice, I'm even aware of my mind and I change the thought. I change the angry thought. That's high school. Another time, I might actually reach out and be kind to somebody. That's compassion being practiced. So you've got to know where all the stuff fits. You know, because we don't think of spiritual teachings like that. So you've got to know what your capability is. If you can't do more than just shut your mouth, at least shut your mouth. If you can't do more than control your mouth and control your speech, and your mind, do at least that. Then when you're ready, you can even do the word of your kind. You know, praising somebody. But that's more advanced. Progressively. So when we realise emptiness, that's the beginning of the end of suffering. From there on we can't, you know, we go forward. And that is the beginning of the end also of this sense of a separate self. So that really does sound abstract for us. So when you really develop the two wings of the bird, not even all the way to Buddha, already how would you be? You'd have this enormous sense of your own contentment, your own fulfillment. You'd be joyful, you'd be fulfilled, you'd be happy, you'd be patient, you'd be content, you'd be wise. You're fulfilled in yourself, because less attached, less angry, less fearful. And you'd have enormous empathy for others, as if somehow you get a closer and closer. That's why that wonderful man, if you saw that from the show about, what was it called?
Chapel.
What's it called?
Wayside Chapel
in Sydney, and that new guy's taking over, that amazing Sri Lankan guy. Did everybody see him on the telly?
Yeah.
Wasn't it extraordinary being? So you can see he was just this beaming, happy, blissful person, utterly content in himself, and at the same time, the incredible empathy for others. These two go together. Whereas it was just happiness that comes from satisfying our senses. We're not something moralistic. It's just very temporary, and it's totally self-centered. Whereas joy, and that's the Buddha's point, that man is the proof of the pudding, that there's not much anger and attachment and jealousy and pride. You are happy, naturally. Contentment for the Buddha comes not from eating cakes and getting praise, but from lessening attachment. You kind of grow your own sense of fulfillment and joy. Literally, and I mean literally, this is the way they describe it in Buddhist practice. Then it's easy to have empathy, no problem. And the more wisdom, the more compassion. And eventually you can perfect both of those. That's what it's deal. So we finally become this who we really are, you know, become our own true nature. Is that what I'm saying?
Robina, if we could really think of ourselves as not separate,
yeah.
Would that be...
It's a nice theory. We've got to be realistic about where we're at in it. Of course we do. It's perfect to think that. Continually remember that. But we have to know where we're at in that. Do you not understand? Oh, the process of getting there. So it's a good way to fake it till you make it. Yeah, absolutely.
That will help in emptiness,
well,
right?
Oh, no. What?
It won't help emptiness.
Oh, no, sorry. No, no, it will. So, okay. The wisdom wing is all about the delusions, the mind, unpacking, unraveling. If you completed the wisdom wing, you'd also then realize emptiness. That will be part of the wisdom wing, the nuts and bolts and your own inner stuff, right? So lessening your own neurotic sense of self brings your happiness and your joy. Oh, but of course, it then increases your capacity to be empathetic with others. It does. But when you proactively practice compassion, then that loosens the grip of the separate I. So you consciously work on loosening the grip of the separate I in the wisdom wing, and you consciously help others in the compassion wing, and each helps the other. So every time you lessen your own sense of an I, you increase your capacity for empathy. Every time you proactively practice empathy, you lessen the grip of the I, but they're both particular specific practices. You get my point?
Mm.
And that's why I burn these two wings.
Mm.
So this is why it's so important in the Buddhist teachings. You've got to really understand they're all incremental. They're very specific and very stage by stage, progressive. And that doesn't seem evident to us sometimes. You really have to understand that. The compassion teachings are necessarily more advanced. We will do all every day. Of course we do. We've got to know where we're at. But you can't accomplish certain levels of compassion until you've accomplished certain levels of wisdom. It's like you can't accomplish, you know, university, you've accomplished high school, And you can't accomplish high school until you become a junior school. You can practice all of them, but you know where you're at in each of them. And that really is the same way they describe in this packaging of the teachings in Buddhism in Tibet. It's very unique to the Tibetans. Initially, it doesn't seem very evident, but it's enormously helpful. Enormously helpful. When you read the teachings, you know what, you can read where you're at and what you do. You can map yourself in it, you know where you're at and what you can cope with. Yeah.
Last night, you mentioned the Lama Yeshe book on
Mahamudra. Yes, I did.
In that context that you're speaking about, in terms of the levels of advancedness, Mahamudra is high.
Mahamudra is taught at a more advanced level, definitely.
But you can.
But anybody can practice. Talking about, using this analogy of junior school, high school. As you know, the Lam readings, the packaging they use is 14th century Tsongkhapa, our lineage Lama, 14th century. So he did this packaging of all the Buddhist teachings we're familiar with when we study it all. And so he calls it the Lam Rim. Pa, gradual. Well, the word that for me is really logical that we use in the modern world is the word a course. So you do a course in medicine, a course in horticulture. It's progressive, it's gradual, isn't it? So you know very well, you enter into junior school level, you go to high school, you go to university, and you go to postgraduate, don't you? It's logical, we get it immediately, we hear that. So, the wisdom wing is junior school and high school, or as the Tibetans would politely put it, as Lama Zopa respectfully admiring the lineage would say, the junior school, as I call it, is the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. That's exactly how he said it. Then you go to the next level, and that's the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the middle capability. Then you go to the compassion wing, and that's the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the greatest capability. You understand? The three scopes, as they call it. Well, I'd rather go junior school, high school, university, we can get that somehow. Well, then you've got Vajrayana, or Tantra, and that's postgraduate. Mm. So that's the most. So it's usually taught, even though it's a sutra practice, it's taught in the context of Tantra, but it's always taught in the context of receiving an initiation into a higher sort of Tantra initiation. It's always taught in that context. So it was a secret teaching for centuries. Mm. It's a particular way of realizing emptiness, a very tasty, delicious way of realizing emptiness. So it's always true. But Lama, the way Lama Yeshe teaches, it's always very delicious and manageable. Do you understand? And we can all try it. I mean, he gave a course here in 1991, and there were brand new people there who probably never heard it before. So Lama had this marvelous way. And that is the point about all the teachings. Vajrayana is always the most advanced. The compassion was before that. And they're all progressive. But you can teach all of them at a simple level. Do you understand?
Yes,
I do. Well, yesterday we did a chain raising meditation. That's from Vajrayana. That's from postgraduate. Mm-hmm. But I did it the simplest way to try and get the psychology or just the logical, not a more complex way.
Yeah.
But they're complex teachings, they're more advanced. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What else do we do? Almost tea time. We keep having tea breaks, don't we? Look, it's time for tea again. Come on. Lunch time, morning time, tea time, whatever you want. Afternoon tea time.
Chai
time. Good, okay. Okay, no more urgent questions? You did okay? How are you going, Frank? You coping?
Thank you, Lavina. Very kind to ask. I have a little cold.
Oh, sweetheart. I'm so sorry, darling. What a nice question. I'm going to hand it over there, huh? Ross will recover from my nose operation. For years and years, I haven't been able to breathe properly, right? Because I had a friend who was at the ear, nose, throat specialist in California Center, and I had a quick meeting. She said, oh, that's easy. She poked the thing up my nose and said, you have a septoplasty and a turbinates reduction. So she explained that the nose gets all crooked and the channel gets all twisted, and all these things grow, these bits of flesh, kind of called turbinates, and they block you from breathing. So I was so excited, I couldn't believe I'd be able to breathe finally. So one of the women on our trek this year, Nadia, her husband's a plastic surgeon in the city, so I emailed her and said, can you help me do this one? So I didn't think I'd be able to come, get it. I have to probably wait for 10 years, so it's not an urgent operation, is it? So I don't want to wait. I thought, even I'll find some money and I'll pay for the damn thing, So he managed to do it. But then it's been 2 weeks now, and they said a few weeks before it finished, but I feel it's the same as ever. So then he discovered when he went down there, he said with his camera, he saw this kind of mucosa type stuff that he thought was adenoids. Because they can grow back. You can, they usually grow away when you're a child, but it's possible they're there, so that could be the real reason I can't breathe. So all my bloody money wasted on getting me nose sprays. But then I went to an ENT guy at the Iron Ear in Melbourne, so I was really anxious the bleeding wasn't stopping. And so he said, well, I can't put a camera down here because you've got to wait till you get healed. But he said, that's what you need to do, because maybe you've got to go back to base and get my bloody adenoids down if they're still there. Maybe that's why I can't breathe. Anyway, I was so excited to get it done, and now I'm disappointed.
Is it healing?
Yeah, it's healing. It's all the bits are stopping them, and the stitches are still there. They're kind of dropping away. Mm-hmm. And it's healing, I think. In 2 weeks since I had it.
So you look good.
Do you have any bruises? I've seen people with bruises. I have no bruises. Anyway, still sniffing. You can hear it. Same symptoms as before, no difference, not changed. Mm-hmm. Masses of mucus and snot coming. It's not going that nicely, you know, not going back and down like it should, coming out the top. You know, excuse me. Don't enjoy your tea, please.